Okay, so welcome to this next lecture on virtual machines. I'm sorry that I was not in on last Tuesday. I was ill. Sorry. So now we were concerned with pointers and how to implement them. We have realized that our stack is no longer sufficient to maintain dynamically allocated data structures, and so therefore we decided to install a heap. And the bottommost cell of the heap was pointed at by the new pointer. And now our goal is to use this kind of extension of our runtime system to realize pointers. So two things we have, two duties have to be dealt with. One is to set a pointer, and the other thing is to access via pointer. So setting and dereferencing a pointer. So now, first, how to set a pointer. So there are two possibilities to set a pointer. The first thing is we create some new portion of storage somewhere on the heap, and then return a pointer to it. And that is typically done by means of a function called malloc. So I guess this is nothing new, which I tell you. So there is a function malloc which receives an argument. The argument should provide you with a space to be allocated. In reality, this is the amount of space measured in byte, typically, or whatever. Actually, I don't know whether that is really fixed, whether it should be necessarily bytes, but at least it is the size of the data object to be created. And then this malloc returns an address, which points to this portion of memory. So now then we have no possibility so far to return some, to create and to determine the address of some piece of memory on the heap. So therefore this means we require a new instruction. So therefore the malloc is translated in such a way. First, we determine the value of its argument, and then something new must happen, and since we do not know how to implement it with our current set of instructions, we create a new instruction, and this new instruction is called new. Okay, and then that's the first thing. Now what will the new thing do? Here is the implementation of new. So it expects a number on top of the stack. Then it kind of will try to decrement the new pointer in the appropriate number of cells. And then the new pointer points to the bottommost cell of all these newly allocated things. So therefore it is the value which we return on top of the stack. And since the argument is consumed, so the argument is simply replaced by this address. So there's only one catch, which we have to take care that we can do that only if there is sufficiently much space available. If there's not enough space, this is checked by comparing the decremented new pointer with the extreme pointer. If so, the new pointer would clash into the extreme pointer, then we cannot allocate the memory, and then we return null. And that is what I explained to you last time. Inside C, we are able to deal with the situation that there is not enough heap space available. For stack space, we can't do anything, but for heap space, we can, and we should. So this means an experienced C programmer will always check the return value of malloc for null. Okay? So, So that is one thing. So the new pointer is not changed if there's not enough space. Otherwise, it is changed, and the new pointer is returned. So that's for the malloc. There's only one more point to make, and that is that malloc is not here. It is kind of considered as built in to the C, something which is built into the C language. In the real world, it is not built into the C language. It is just a library function, because malloc. So is it possible next time that you arrive a little bit earlier? Because it's a little bit of a nuisance if people keep on entering while I'm talking. Thank you. So here we build it into the language by providing direct virtual support through our virtual machine. In reality, malloc maintains kind of a more or less complicated data structure, and it's just an auxiliary function. So it's just a library function. Yeah, and I guess you can exchange one malloc implementation by another by replacing this library. Yeah, but here for the moment, since we have to deal with it, and again to you also, it would be nice if you next time arrive a little bit earlier, because so it's always bad if you arrive late. So still, but come in. So then the other thing, how to create a pointer is by placing applying the address operator to a variable. So that is, you have already a allocated something, and now you want to kind of set a pointer to it, and that is done by means of this address operator. And in some sense, so if it is a variable, then if you have a variable x, then address of x should be the address of x, and that is the L value. So that means address of E will, the R value, code R of address of E will return the L value of E. Yeah, so that is, therefore, code R of address of E is the same as the L value of E. So that is, by going from here, we change the code generation scheme, and by that eat up one operator. Okay? So that is... Now that was for creating addresses. Now the question is, how do we do the dereferencing? Now, for that there is this star operator, and applied to assuming that an expression E returns an address, then star E should return the content of this of the storage cell. Now again, we may ask, or put it differently, if we want to have the L value of the thing, which is not of E but of star E, then this is the address pointed at by E, and that is just the R value of E. So again, we simply here translate the address operator switched from code R to code L by eating up the operator, and here we switch from code L to code R by eating up the operator. So in that sense, it's the dual thing. Now let us see how that is. Well, these are rules, we can put them up. The question is, how do they what is their interplay? Do they work well in practice? So for that, we might consider, for example, consider such data structure. such a sequence of declarations. So you see here there is a type T declared consisting of an array of seven elements followed by a pointer again to a struct of this type B. Yeah, and then we have two ints, and then we have so this is a declaration, the first thing is a declaration of a type. Now we then have a declaration of a variable, which is a pointer to such a thing T. Yeah, this is this PT. And if we have these kind of declarations, we might kind of come up with such an expression. And you see what happens here. So PT is a pointer to something of type T. It has a component B, which can be selected, which is again a pointer, which we may dereference, and then select the component A, which is an array from which we select the index I plus 1. Yeah? Now, how can we deal with it? So first, I may recall that this arrow notation is a shortcut. And so E arrow A means first dereferencing E and then selecting A. Yeah, so therefore, if I determine the L value, if I try to determine the L value of this expression, then this means I have to determine the L value of that. And the L value of that is the R value of star E plus the edit to which we add the displacement for the appropriate component, namely here A. Now the L value of this E star A is the L value of star E, and then followed adding of the displacement, and the L value of star E as we have learned, exactly the R value of E. So this means we first take, so the arrow is implemented as taking the R value of E and then adding the displacement corresponding to A. No, this works all the time. It's about the L value. This is a general thing. So it's the L value. So here now, for this particular example, expression, to kind of visualize what that means is, so we have here the PT, which points to some memory portion. Inside this data object, we have this component B, which points to another such data portion, the first address, and then I may select A, which is just the first component, and then inside here I find the I plus 1 somewhere there. Okay, so that's the picture. Now how do we generate code for it? And you may agree with me that manually it is a little bit mind-boggling to do following these arrows and see what one has to do there. But if we do it in a systematic way, then all these schemes which we have collected now come at our rescue. So that's actually the lesson which you should learn. So here for that, so this is on the top level. This is an array index. So according to our schemes, we first have to determine the R value of the array. We then have to determine the R value of the index. Then we have to do the scaling and then the adding. And then we get the L value. Clearly here you see we have to scale with 1. This is due to our memory decision of memory layout. But In reality, if it's int, then it might be very well scaling with 8 or scaling with 4. Okay, so having seen that, now we can kind of descend and see that we have here something, which a recursive call to cogeneration, so we might want to expand it. And so this is in the easy part. Load code R for E plus 1 is load the content of E, load the constant 1, and add. So that's fine. Yeah? Now all we are left now is with the more complicated thing, which is this one, which is still there, and which we still have to kind of expand. So this is code R for an array. Code R for an array, we said, is the same as code L for an array. So this is, so here it is, code R for an array is the same as code L for this array. Code L for an arrow expression was code R for the expression, extended, and then this displacement. So now we have to compute code R for PT arrow B. Okay? Now this is code. So this is here. Now code R for some expression which is not an array is you first determine code L and then you do the you load from there. So that means here this part here, so I make that maybe in red, should be code L for PT arrow B, and then afterwards we do a load. Okay, now the code L for PT arrow B is R value of PT, and then edit the B. So now the R value of PT is we load the content of the variable PT, and that is the PT has relative address 3, so we load from there. And then we add the 7 for the displacement corresponding to B and add. And that's it. So you see, by that, having without our systematic application of the schemes, we would have been doomed. At least, I'm not so sure whether you, by trial and error, would have arrived at that sequence of instructions. Is there any question? So here is now kind of the summary of all these schemes which we have collected. So the code L for this indexing was to do the code R for the E1, the code R for the E2, scaling of the second argument, and then adding. And the code L for a selection was I do the L value of the expression from which to select, and then do add the displacement. And here are the other ones. The first two expand on this code L thing. So code L for the dereferencing means code R for the expression, and code L for a variable is just the address of the variable, loading the address of the variable. And now then here for the code R, we kind of found that we have the address operator can be eaten up by switching to the L, code L, and if I have an array, I simply can go from code R to code L without eating an operator. And when I have an operator application like plus or shift or something, then I apply recursively the code R to the arguments, and then and then generate the instruction corresponding to the operator. Okay, so that's the collection of all these, the kind of the brief summary of all what we have learned so far. Is there a question to that? So now we are happy with that. So a little bit more. So then for the constants, that is also very easy. And for the assignment, we learned that we have, for that we have provided this instruction store. And and if you have any expression which does not conform to these formats which we have seen so far, and we want to determine its R value, then we determine its L value and then load from there. So perhaps we may try another example, so a little bit of other examples. So here is an array of 10 ints, a pointer to an array of 10 ints, and consider a statement star a equals 5. So for that, there's a little bit of star. So here we dereference the A. So A is considered as is an array, so that is a kind of constant pointer, so we may dereference it, and that gives us a the content of the first element inside the array. So the address, so if we try to translate that, so the code L of star A, since A is an array, code L is the code L of star A is the same as code R of A. Now, since A is an array, code R of A is the same as code L of A, and therefore this is just the constant, loading the constant 7, which is the L value of A. And so if we kind of do this, want to do the generate code for that assignment, that therefore means we start with evaluating the right hand side, which is this one. So now we have the right hand side. Then we determine the L value of the left hand side, which is this one. And then we do the store, which implements the assignment, and then we pop. Why do we pop?
Because it's a statement, and so we have to get rid of that last.
Thank you. Yes, because it's a statement. So without the pop, it would be an expression, and this returns the value of the right hand side on top of the stack. But if when we translate a statement, we have to remove it again. Thank you very much. So now let us see what happens if we do this such a thing, that we take B. B is a pointer to an array. So here we may do this. What happens if we try to do this one here? So it was the right hand side is address of A plus 2. So address of A, so is this one here. Then we load the constant 2, and then we would have to add. But now we must be, now comes something which we have to take into account, that this adding depends on the types. And now the type of A is is an array, and therefore if we add, if you have a pointer to if you have an address and we add 2, then the address is the compiler checks whether what this thing points to. In this case it points to an array, and therefore this array has size 10, so therefore this 2 is scaled with 10 before we add. Yeah, and then we load the value of the right-hand side, and then we store, and then perhaps we pop. So here by that you see that in that sense, this code here is, you can execute it, but you receive a pointer to some place, somewhere in memory, where there is no array anymore. Yeah, so this would, if you then access perhaps some data through this B, you would get anything, perhaps segmentation fault, perhaps something. So it's an unpredictable, in some sense, this is not, I guess, in C you are not allowed to access areas where you where there is no data structure. You may do it, but the semantics is undefined, and the compiler may even remove this kind of instructions because it has no semantics. Yeah? Okay. And the same happens if you do here this B plus 3 and then the star, because the B is a pointer to an array, and then if you add 3, then this 3 is again is also scaled by the size of the array, and you get an address which points to no legal data structure. So therefore here's again this load 10 and load constant 10 for the scaling. Okay. So that is for that reason. So what was the message which I wanted to transport by that? That even if the address of an array is the same as the address of the first element in the array, you kind of must be careful if you what to do with this pointer, because you have to adjust the types so that the pointer arithmetic makes sense. So if you really want to step with a pointer through an array, you have to take you have to do a cast from an array to a pointer to an int. That was for the pointers in a, if you like, in the positive side, where you kind of create pointers and manipulate pointers. The problem is that at some point you also would like to get rid of the data structures which you have allocated. And that is the point of freeing occupied space. And there are at least two problems I know of. The first one is you may think that a certain area in the memory is not used, but is not used anymore. But there could be other pointers to that area, because, for example, I don't know, you free a leaf in your data structure, but somehow the ancestor has another pointer to it, or you saved on some scratch pad shortcuts into your data structure, and so there could be still pointers into the area even if you have freed that area. And that is at first sight this is no problem. So you have simply some pointers; they are simply then outdated. But if you don't realize them to be outdated, you may follow them, and that means you kind of access areas in memory which are invalid or have been reused for some other purpose, and that kind of may cause great chaos. So that is one problem. The other problem is, even if you are very careful with your with maintaining your occupied sections of memory, and always free them only if really nobody else is interested in that area anymore, it happens that you do not do it in some kind of last in or first out forms, but you kind of may free at some point this and then that, and in between you have islands of occupied memory. So you have a memory which looks like a Swiss cheese after some time, and now after so that's well, why is this a problem? So then there are holes there. Who cares? What is the problem there? What is the problem with fragmentation? Ah, thank you for that. But let us try him. Yes, that's it. For example, here virtually only half of the memory is occupied. But if you have a big chunk, you need a big chunk of memory. This big chunk should be contiguous, and there is no such open space. So what could you do? You could try to compact your memory now and then. But that means that you have to move around data objects, and that means you have to adjust all pointers, which is difficult. Or you kind of have, so you need kind of some way how to maintain your free memories, and it's difficult. And even it could be so that you have kind of for example, several free spaces which are adjacent to each other, and then still each of these holes are small, and then your memory management must be smart enough to identify, oh, there are two neighboring holes, I join them to bigger hole. So such kind of tasks must be done, and so by that, from that you can conclude that memory management is not so trivial, and actually the memory management done for malloc is quite sophisticated. So you need to do something there. So what would be now the solution for which we favor? So the first thing is with this dangling references. So for that, there's no way how we can from as a compiler enforce or force the programmer to be prudent. So therefore, we have to trust the programmer, and if he makes stupid things, then he makes stupid things. So this makes programming in C and programming in C++ difficult. So for us in C++, there are some libraries which help to have a clean memory management. Does anybody know of some help offered by the C++ libraries? So there's something like smart pointers, which have something like reference counting built in. And so they count as soon they, if you use them carefully, then you can kind of, then this library will kind of trigger automatic collection as soon as the count drops to zero. So that's a good thing. And by that, you kind of are freed from freeing yourself. So some libraries help, and in some languages on top of C, there is support. But even if you have that kind of thing, then one still has to provide some kind of data structure to maintain free blocks. And these could be more or less sophisticated, and their maintenance is more or less expensive, and this makes malloc or free an expensive operation. So, for example, if there are blocks of particular sizes which programmers like very much, for example, for lists or so, that is, these are blocks of very for particular types, you could kind of keep free lists so that whenever something is allocated of that size, then you look first in the free list whether something is in there, and if you free something, you put it into that free list. So by that you can get rapid access to popular object sizes. So that is something which one could do, and you could invest even more subtle ideas to improve storage management. But here we take a very radical and very simple view. We say, okay, one implementation of free is you do nothing. Because at least from then you do not throw away portions which perhaps are still referenced to. And the only thing what happens is that your memory is former or later eaten up. But that's kind of... So that is kind of a limitation, but besides that, we will not dive into implementations of this memory management here. So we will soon see other programming languages which have managed heap, and that means there we will have automatic garbage collection. But here for the moment we do nothing. Now, one crucial point is still missing in our implementation of C, and these are functions. So without functions, actually, you cannot do very much. Now, what is a function? So functions have names. Functions typically have parameters, formal parameters, which are used for passing into the function arguments and for sometimes even for returning results. And there is a possible result type. So these are things which you kind of have in the header, if you like, in the prototype of your function, and then you need an implementation of your function, and that is a kind of a block of statements and declarations. So now if somewhere in our code a function, the name of a function occurs, how should we interpret it? And the point is that the R value of such, so it's again considered, a function name is considered as in a similar way as an array, namely as a constant pointer. So it's not only that it doesn't point to some memory, but to in the plain memory, but to some also to some memory, but in the code section. So that means the R value of a function is the same as the start address of the function. Okay? And that means, for that reason, and here we use that convention that this underscore F, this is a placeholder for the start address of a function f. And so these function names we will also maintain in our address environment, because they are mapped to addresses. So then we briefly mentioned it when we discussed variables. So variables have scopes and lifetimes. So far we have kind of assumed when there is a variable X, then there is this variable X accessible all the time, and its lifetime is as long as the program runs. So this is true for global variables. But there are other variables, which namely those which live inside functions. So these are the local variables. So here, for example, what kind of local variables do we have here? So, for example, in this implementation of the factorial function, you could consider the formal parameter as a variable which is local to this function. And here in this main function here has also a local variable, which is this n here. And and this local variable has a scope, and that means it is visible and can be accessed by means of the name only inside the body of that function. So here this x can only be, where can that x be accessed? This x can be accessed only within this yellowed part of the code. Yeah. And inside this, now there is another call to the factorial function inside this, because this inside this body of the factorial function itself. So this is the recursive call. Now inside this factorial function, there's also an x, but this is another x. So we have kind of several copies of the same, of the same x, or put it differently, you have different x's. So let us see what goes on if we kind of look at a run of this function main. So if we have a run of this function main, we start here. And then we may, so then we have to call the factorial function. So this is the first call to the factorial function. But before that call of the factorial function is done, we have to do a subsequent call to the factorial function, namely here. So this is this call. And this call, again, is another, if you like, instance of the factorial function, which again does a recursive call, namely this one. And only that one then will terminate directly without subsequent call. But you see, when we are at that level here, there are two other, if you like, pending calls to the factorial function. And here is an x, and the x initially has which value? 2. Yeah, so this is 2. Then the next factorial, which value will that have, the next call? So it is called, as you see here, with x minus 1. So this is 2 minus 1. So here at that level, x has the value 1. And then there is down there, and then there's another call, and then there's here another x with the value 0. So we have 3 x's with 3 different values. And so we must keep them different, separate. Okay? You see the 3 x's. It's always the formal parameter by which, so you pass to the first factorial the value 2 as the actual argument, but then inside the function you access this argument via the formal parameter x. So therefore x equals 2. And the same goes on. And so here this x is the same as that x. So you use that to compute x minus 1, and then you get a value which is 1, for example. And this 1 is passed to the next call, and then there the formal parameter receives the value 1. Okay? So you see the 3 x's with the 3 different values. And you have to keep them separate. Why? Because when you return, when I have returned from that call here, I still have use, although there was a new x in between for the recursive call, I need the old value of x because I have to multiply them. So I cannot throw it away and kind of keep one global x and then put all the values in there. Then I would have only 0, and then I would not be able to multiply. Yeah. So therefore I have to maintain somewhere for each recursive call the values of the formal parameter. And if there were other locals like this one, I would also have to maintain these locals. Okay? So that I have to take care in the implementation and in my memory management. So that means for every, so the idea therefore is for every function, I allocate a particular portion of stack, and there I put all the local variables and formal parameters. Yeah? So that is what I wanted to kind of communicate to you, or share with you this insight that we have to provide, or it is a decent idea to provide for every call of a function a dedicated memory block for the locals. And now then, and that is now kind of comes at now it is very convenient that this memory block that you can maintain these memory blocks as like a stack. So this is okay. So this is helpful. So perhaps it is natural to you and it's natural to me, but it's definitely helpful because it says it gives us also kind of memory management for these blocks. So because the stack is something very easy to maintain, we just decrement the top of we pop by just decrementing the stack pointer. Yeah. And why is it so? Because the last function to be entered is kind of popped, is finished first. So this is the stack kind of follows the procedure calls and how they are executed follow the stack discipline. And these portions of stack which we put on to these blocks of memory which we allocate on the stack for each procedure are also called stack frames. That is what people call it. Now let us see how we kind of how we organize this stack frame for every function. So you see here that there are several sub portions which have a dedicated use. So somewhere we need space for organizational cells. We will discuss these organizational cells in detail soon. But one thing is clear: if I may enter a function from different, so there could be a call to a function f from that call site or from that call site or from yet another call site. And so once you are done with the function, you need to know where to continue. Yeah, where did I come from? What is the place where I have to continue with my computation? And this kind of return address, if you like, this is the PC old, which is stored on the stack. And this, in the same sense, is this frame pointer old. So now, what is a frame pointer? So now, our convention is, in order to do the addressing within a stack frame, we do it not absolutely. This is not possible because there are the same function may exist. With multiple stack frames, but we use kind of a specific pointer into the stack frame to address relative to that pointer. Yeah, so that we can again use relative addresses for accessing local variables. Okay, so that means addressing inside the stack frame is all tied to this frame pointer. Now this is for our current function. Now what happens with the frame pointer to the caller from which we came? So that is kind of, well, what happens? What should we do with it? So one possibility is to store, like the PC old, to store it on the stack. And there's another thing, and if you come to think about it, so whenever you kind of have a call to some new procedure or function, and then you do executing there, you have to save all the registers which you will use. If you use, because you will, for example, what are the registers which you use? It is the PC which we use, it is the frame pointer which we use, and there's also the current extreme pointer. These are the three registers which we have. And in reality, if you think of your favorite hardware, when you do a C compiler there, then you would, then you might have more registers, which then are used by your current function call. And then, well, then you have to save the values of these registers somewhere in order to restore them later, so that you that a computation can continue after the call with the caller of the current procedure. So, and since we have three registers in our machine only, we save all of them here into these organizational cells. So these are the, this is the explanation of the organizational cells. Now I said, okay, so we have here these, we have here this frame pointer to point, to keep track of one particular fixed address inside our, the current stack frame. Now, relative to this frame pointer, we now may address the local variables. So this means local variable y1, y2, y3 may then be placed inside the stack frame relative to, on top of the address, on top of the memory cell, which is addressed by the frame pointer. So these are the locals. And then there is something more. There is these formals. So the formals, they carry the arguments of the function. And for interest, so one possibility is we could place them also here on top of the frame pointer. Another alternative is to place them in this area below the organizational memory cells. And here we will follow the latter approach. So the formals will be placed below the organizational cells, then come the organizational cells, and then come the locals. And then there is, that is kind of the principal organization, and then there is one more thing, and that is on top of the locals, there is this portion, which is where this blue area, this is used for our local computations, because we have to evaluate expressions, and that requires a little bit of stack also to do the expression evaluation. So this, if you like, this is a kind of the temporary stack. So again, speaking aside, if you have a real hardware with many registers, then you could register, then you could do expression evaluation mostly in registers. Then you would not need this local stack. Okay, so so according to this kind of philosophy, which I have tried to explain to you, the local variables receive addresses relative to the frame pointer, and so they receive addresses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the formals, as they are placed below the organizational cells relative to the frame pointer, they therefore receive negative addresses. So here you see, so if that is, this has minus 1, this has minus 2, and here this has minus 3. Now why do I put the locals, the formals below the organizational cells, and the reason is that is the, since C allows you to define functions with a variable number of arguments. Now, variable number of arguments, what does it mean? So it is with these dots. This means that the function itself does not know how many arguments it has been provided with. It is only the caller who places sufficiently many arguments on top of the stack, then calls the function. So therefore, in that sense, you could think of that the function itself knows I have at least two arguments, so these are perhaps here, but there could be more. And this is these more arguments, so in that sense we are this organization is, if you like, open with respect to the lower portion of the stack frame. And so now, why is it? What are these multiple arguments good for? So I have written printf. What is the specific thing with printf, for example?
Well, you can use a string, and inside the string define some placeholders for other parameters that will then be filled in, and you can have a variable number of
placeholders. And those, yeah. So this is. Maybe one might consider that as an old-fashioned way how to do output, but at least it is convenient and often used. You have, as you said, you have these placeholders, and each of them could be something of a particular type, and then you place these things to the left of then this director string in some sense is the first argument, and then you may have as many arguments as necessary to provide the values for the placeholders. So there is similar, by the way, a similar mechanism with a variable number of arguments is also available, I guess, in Java. So how do in Java they pass the arguments, the multiple arguments? So they have a different philosophy. They collect them into an array and then pass this array as a parameter. So I guess this is mostly also the case in C. So you cannot use different variable type things there. They must all agree in the type. I'm not so sure what happens with the printf. Maybe it's all addresses which you pass.
I think it's because you have the string with the definition of how all parameters have to be interpreted, and the end is only void pointer.
Yes. So this void pointer is something like a polymorphic type which fits everything, which is not too large. Okay, by this kind of memory organization for the stack frame, we kind of at least support this variable number of arguments. We have another thing which we have to think about, and that is the return value. So where is the where should the return value be returned? So the return value at the end should survive the call. So this is kind of the information which one piece of information which we extract from the call. And so therefore, if I place it up here, then in the pop the stack frame, then this return value would be kind of lost. So the idea therefore is to place the return value down there. And in this in this portion for the formal parameters, because this we simply, so in that sense, this portion has a double use. As soon as we return values, we do no longer need the formal parameters. There is kind of, we have a little bit of a, the question is how much memory, how big is the data structure which a function may return? And in the very early implementations of versions of C, you could only return an int or something which is of the same size, or an address. Modern versions of C allow you also to return structs, but here we kind of make our lives a little bit simpler by assuming that the return value fits into a single memory cell alone. But that's kind of a simplification. By the way, there is one would this is, I find that always interesting to see. So in principle, C is a functional language, as the function is. So is the key concept in C, but it's quite different from a functional language, as the return value typically does not return the, if you like, so the things which have been determined, computed by the function call, but typically, at least in the pure C programmer, or according to C philosophy, the return value of a function is just what? Yes, kind of a status information. It typically returns you a status information. You may inspect whether it were, it succeeded or whether it failed or what went wrong and so on. And the, how do they return values? Usually by pointer. So you pass some address kind to the function and hope that the function will kind of use this address, which addresses some portion of memory, to write there the results. So, and if you think of this kind of, if you follow that philosophy, then the return value either is an int or an enum, which is also nothing else but an int. Okay, so now let's see how we can so that is kind of general philosophy around functions. Now let us see what we have to, how the code might look like, which we have to, which we generate for a function. So there are two things which we have, two portions which we have to generate code for. The first one is, okay, so the body has it, the function has a body. So this is kind of the implementation of the function. We have to provide code for it. And then there's another thing. At some places in our program, the function is called. So we have to generate code for the calls. And now at runtime, what happens at runtime? So this is generating two pieces of code. Okay, so that is the code generators and compilers' duty. But now the compiler writer has to kind of keep in mind what happens at runtime. And at runtime, these portions of code are executed in some sense intertwined. So you have this code for the call, which is kind of executed, and then hopefully you jump to the implementation. You run that block, the code for the body of the function, and somehow you return. And then you continue. So that means whatever code we want to have executed, we may decide whether we place it at the call side or whether in the implementation of the function itself. You see? So we have these choices. And now, how do we do this choice? What is kind of our criterion to decide which code to place here and which code to place there? So at the call side, we can place all information which we see from the code there. So we see the arguments, we can provide code for evaluating the arguments. We see the number of arguments, we can provide take precautions of that. But we do not see the code of the function. So everything which is related to the code of the function, we cannot, any information extracted from there, we cannot place at the call site. This is in particular true because we could have kind of a multi-file program, and then we would like to have separate compilation. So at the idea is, whatever we do at the call site, it should be independent of the implementation of the function. And likewise, for the function, we can use only information given the function itself, not about the callers. Because that should, the implementation of the function should serve all purposes, even callers which we have not yet seen or which will be implemented later. Okay, so we have kind of this we should keep in mind when we decide what to do where. Okay, so then another thing which we have to take care of when we want to implement the function is that now for variable x we have to treat it differently if it is a global variable or if it is a local variable. So that is an extra information which we have to maintain somewhere, and one possibility to maintain it is to maintain it inside the address environment. And clearly, so one could kind of, various programming languages, you might have different, not only global and local, but you might have more refined notions of visibility. And also inside C, there are certain further different scales. For example, you might have file scope, or you might have program scope, or you might have something like that something is visible to, it is global, but it is visible only to a function, to all calls of a function. Things like these kind of extra distinctions one should take care of. It is not so much for that, the compiler must take care of, and in particular, and the programmer must take care of, because these make a difference in the semantics. But for us, from the principal point of view, we only distinguish between local and global. So now for the, let us, but this local versus global is something which, from program point to program point, may change. So, for example, let us see this example. So here we have various address environments depending on at which program point we are. So, for example, so we have these global declarations here up front. Yeah, so there is a global variable I and a global pointer L, which points to a struct containing certain components. Okay, so these are global, and they exist, if you like, outside of all function declarations. Now come this function declaration, let us make it in green, this one. And here you see there's another I introduced as a formal parameter. Now we have two I's, this I here, this global I, and this formal parameter I. And that means inside the I-th, inside the implementation of the function ith, inside the function ith, this one here is no longer visible. It is still there, but is no longer visible. Why? Because if you write I there, it is the formal parameter is referred to. Okay, and then additionally you have this x here. This x is a local variable. Okay, and this next here, this is a selector, so this is, if you like, this is global. Okay, and then now you got the idea. Now let's see this function main. There you also have, so you also notice that here's a local variable, this is this k, and and here, okay, here is referred to the variable I, but this I here refers to, there is no local variable I, so therefore this I refers to this one. And then here is an L. Here is an L. And this L refers to this L. And then comes... So here is therefore an L and an I, and these are the same. So they refer to the global variables. So that means when you are at a U, when you see in a block a use of a variable I, you might check from going further and further out whether you hit a declaration in the code of that. Of a variable of that name, and the nearest declaration is the one which matters for you. So in this case, you go outside, inside main, there is no declaration of I and L, so there you find, but you find it on the top level. While if you look at this particular instance of I, then you go to the surrounding block and you find. You find that this I refers to this I. Okay? And accordingly, so we may collect now for these three points for this program point 0, we might, for the global, we might collect a global address environment. This is this row 0, which gives binds the I and L to identifies them as globals and gives them relative addresses 1 and 2. Inside I, the I now is kind of no longer visible, so instead there is a local I. And while the L still is visible and therefore still has the same is mapped to the same pair G, 2 by the address environment. And we also should kind of note perhaps that the address environment should maintain the names of visible functions. And so inside ith, the function ith itself is visible before declaration of ith, this function is not visible. So that is, it is slightly different from Java, where inside a class you can use all the methods which are declared in this class. So this is not the case here in C. So you can, visible are only those functions which you have already seen. Okay. So that is for the address environments. Now let us see what else do we have to take into account. And the next thing which we notice is that we evaluate actual parameters of functions not in a left-to-right fashion, as we might have perhaps guessed, but we prefer to evaluate them in a right-to-left fashion. Why is this convenient? This is convenient because by that we kind of... to the right are those which we are not completely sure whether they are there or not. So in some sense, they are farthest away from the organizational cells. while the ones which we are sure, they are to the left of the list of formal parameters, and these should reside topmost on the stack. So in that sense, if we evaluate from right to left, we place the formal parameters in the right order on top of the stack. Yeah, and as an effect, the first parameter resides by that directly below the organizational cells, while all others are farther away. So this means the X1, what kind of relative address does receive the first formal parameter? Okay, it should be below the, if here, maybe I make a little bit of a picture. So assume that these are the organizational cells, and now assume that the X1 occupies two memory cells. Then the frame pointer is assumed to be here. So what do we have to do? Okay, so this here, this memory cell here is FP-3. And so FP, and here this, so we have to assign to X FP-4. And that is exactly the relative address -2 minus the size of the type of X1. Okay? And accordingly, so then the next one, the X2, should then, for you have to go down further again, always by the size of the corresponding parameter, and that gives you in the end this formula here. Okay. And so that means inside main, what would be what kind of so that would be perhaps the last from our example. I did not. So this kind of explanation, I did not explain why this -4 and -3 happened to be the relative addresses for the formal parameters I and X. Let us see again that the code here, the implementation of ith, says that X is the first parameter. It has size 1, and therefore we have to subtract its relative address is -2, -1 is -3, and then gets the next relative address. This is -4, exactly as spelled out here. So this is the calculation which led to these -4 and -3 numbers here. Okay? And now inside the domain is in that sense then easier, because there are no formal parameters, only locals. I and L are still, the globals I and L are still visible, so therefore they receive G1 and G2. And K, then this is a local variable, it receives the first available address for locals, which is 1. Okay, and then additionally we have these inside main, ith can be called and main can also be called. Okay? So that was kind of this address environment, so that we have to take a special care of. Once again, please keep in mind, for every function you have your own address environment, which you have to compose from the globals, from your locals and formal parameters. So now let's That is for the address environment. Now let's come to the most interesting part of the implementation of functions, namely the question, what kind of, how does the code look for the, in general, how, what do we have to do in order to correctly implement the call and exit to functions? As I have already told you, we have to do two things. First, we have to collect all the activities which have to be realized, and then we have to divide them into the portion which we put at the caller, inside the caller, and the portion which we put into inside the callee. And the first thing which we note is that this actual, the space requirements of the actual parameters, that one is only known to the caller, at least in case that we have a variable number of parameters. So here is what, at least in my, what I perceive important when a function g is when a call to a function g is implemented. So first, well, in order to do so, we first have to, there are arguments. These are the actual parameters which must be evaluated. And that means why do, now you can say, okay, so what, why not? In fact, so this is a particular thing here. The actual parameters must be evaluated because it's called by value, what is implemented by C. So there are other languages, and somebody came to me last time, and you with this call by reference or versus call. Yeah, so there are subtle notions of various forms of parameter passing in different languages. Here in C, it's the most, in some sense, the simplest one. It's kind of brutal. You have to compute to evaluate to a value, and then you pass the value. And if you want to have something else, so then you have to pass a pointer, but that is also a value. So this is this evaluation of actual parameters. So then, now we have the, you can think of that we evaluate the parameters and put them onto the stack. So there they are now, and can be accessed by the called functions, so that's fine. But then is also, then we said that we have to save kind of the state of computation of the caller, which means the registers of the caller, so that we later can restore the current state of execution of the caller, and so that the caller can continue seamlessly. In some sense, this is like, so I like to see it as such. You compute, you make a, you have to do a complicated computation. So you start on one sheet of paper, and then at some point you see, here is a subtask which I might solve. So I put a fresh piece of paper on top of it, then I do the scribbling there, solve the subproblem, and then copy the results of it into my main computation and simply throw away the sheet on top of it and then continue. But for that I have to continue, and that is the saving of the registers. So that you can continue in the state of that the caller can continue as if nothing had been has interrupted him. So this is this part, and then so this is the preparation of it. So I save already these two things, and then somehow I have to determine where is my function G to help me for the subtask. Now you might say, what is this, a kind of a problem? The G is written there in the code. So why, what is the problem? The G could be written in the code, yes, but it need not. So it could also be just a pointer to something. It could be that the function to be called is somewhere residing in a struct, and you call it via a pointer. So in some sense, this means that You might have to evaluate a complicated expression until you arrive at really the start code of the function. Yeah? So this means there are some, in some cases at least, there is a significant work to do in order to determine the start address of the function g. Okay? So this must be done at some point, and it is here, done here. Okay? Now, then we kind of know where to jump to, where there is, we have the function g in our hands. Now we kind of can try to establish an environment so that the function g may execute. And that means we have to set, for example, the new frame pointer. Because so far we have done everything with the old frame pointer. Now at some point we have to kind of create a new frame pointer. And that is, this we can do now because we have saved the old one. So it's not lost. Okay. Now, so that is all, and at some point we also have to save the PC, where we have to continue once the intermediate task is done. So this is this one. We have to save our the PC of the caller. And now, then everything is prepared, and then we can jump to into G, or at the beginning of the code of G, and then hope to that G then knows what to do. And the first thing what G does, it has to do, is to set the EP. The G knows how much stack space it will require. So the caller does not know how much stack space G will require. It only knows its own stack space. So the EP is only for the execution, is only sets a bound to the consumption of the stack within the current call of the current procedure. And nothing more. So this is the only thing which we can know. And so therefore, if a new function is called, then this new function in the first go must inspect, or the compiler has inspected, how much stack space is used in this current call of that function G, and therefore the EP is set. Yeah, and you see the old EP has been saved. So therefore, when we return from that call, we can restore the old EP. Yeah, so that is the new EP must be set. Then there are locals. These locals have not yet been allocated, and they are allocated now. So now the locals are allocated, and then execution can continue. Now, and by kind of providing you with this list, in somehow I have naturally there is a natural separation what can be done by the caller and what must be done by the callee. So, for example, this determining the start, so this part, evaluating the actual parameters, saving FP and EP, determining the start address, these are things, and saving until here, these are all things which can only be done by the caller. Yeah? Because only the caller knows the PC and therefore can set it and things like that. Well, the frame pointer could also be set later, but we may set it all also at that point. And then jump at the beginning of E, okay, so this is also be done by the caller. But then we are inside G. And so the rest, like setting the new EP and allocating locals, this is definitely part of the called function only. Why? Because only the called function knows its own code and therefore how much stack space it needs, and also it only the called function G knows how many locals it will require. Okay? Now we have kind of this, we have the subdivision of tasks. We have the task, we have the subdivision of tasks, and now we have to kind of see what of it, which kind of tasks we can implement with our current set of instructions and for which we need new instructions. So this saving of these registers, for that we need a new instruction. This is kind of, traditionally it is kind of marking of a stack frame. So that is something new. Then setting the new frame pointer, saving PC and jumping to the beginning, that we might call these three tasks, which kind of are executed always together, could be joined into one instruction, which I call call. And then this setting of the new extreme pointer, that for that I provide a instruction which I call enter, and then allocating the locals, so there's also a new instruction which is called alloc. Now you have seen the new instructions which we require for the entering of the functions. We will see now how these we will see next how these work in detail, and also then in, check what we do have to do in order to return to the caller. But for today, I guess time is over. Thank you for your attention, and have a nice day, and we meet hopefully tomorrow. At least I don't feel ill, and I hope I can make it. Thank you.